Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Anna Mateo, and Jonathan Evans. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report.
Terry Terzinski works hard to help young people in the American state of Michigan succeed after they complete high school. Terzinski is a school counselor at a special public school called the Calhoun Area Career Center in Battle Creek, Michigan. There, students in their final 2 years of high school take classes that relate directly to industries in which they might work someday. Terzinski makes students' plans after high school a priority, whether they expect to attend college or enter the workforce. Terzinski uses many tools to help her students. She makes regular presentations on issues such as financial aid. She offers special tests to help identify qualities in the students' personalities and how those qualities might relate to a job or field of study. And she also directs students to websites that provide information on colleges and universities.
All of Terzinski's hard work has gained her some national attention. The American School Counselor Association named her its School Counselor of the Year in 2017. But a new study finds that many Americans who either completed a degree program or attended at least some college are unhappy with their high school counselors. They do not feel the advice that their counselors provided about higher education was all that helpful. Terzinski says a lack of personal attention may be one reason why students are unsatisfied. But she notes that most school counselors are in a difficult position. They have more to do than just provide college advice to students. Also, she says, many counselors across the United States are overworked.
In Michigan, we're about 750 students to one school counselor. The American School Counselor Association says it should be 250 to one, but that's not the case. So I would say that some school counselors are probably in a spot where maybe they cannot provide the individual services, getting the students exactly what it is that they need.
The Strata Education Network is a nonprofit organization that supports the growth of higher education in the United States. Last year, it partnered with the research company Gallup to ask over 22,000 Americans about their experiences with college. Researchers focused on where people received advice about what field to study in college and how helpful the advice was. The study found four main sources of advice. There are the formal sources, such as school counselors, websites, and print media. There are informal school-based sources, such as teachers and other staff. There are informal social networks, such as friends and family. And there are informal work-based networks, such as bosses and coworkers. The study showed that formal sources of advice about what to study in college were the second most commonly used, after informal social networks. But only 64% of people who used formal sources found them helpful at all. In other words, formal sources were the least helpful source. By comparison, informal work-based sources were the least used, with only 20% of people using them. Yet 83% of people who did found informal work-based sources to be helpful. In other words, bosses and coworkers were the most valuable sources of all.
Brandon Busteed is Executive Director of Education and Workforce Development at Gallup. He says it is surprising that current and former students find what some might say are the most traditional sources of advice to be so lacking. It's a call to action on a number of fronts. Certainly to think about how we improve the formal advising that happens in and outside of schools, he told VOA, but also to think about how we can ramp up the number of touch points between employers and students. Johnny C. Taylor Jr. is the president of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. His organization supports historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, across the United States. Taylor helped connect the Strata and Gallup researchers with minority communities. Taylor suggests that in addition to being overworked, counselors may also simply have limited knowledge. He argues that many school counselors mostly have professional experience in education. Therefore, they may not always know the best way to go about becoming a chemical engineer or graphic designer, for example. The limits of counselors' knowledge is why schools need to strengthen relationships with both local employers and national professional organizations, Taylor says. These connections can provide counselors with the most up-to-date information about what a job in a given field requires. Counselors can then pass that information to students. In addition, relationships with professional groups might give students a chance to meet with employers and ask important questions themselves. Taylor says those connections are especially important for poor and minority students, whose exposure to people with high-skilled jobs may be limited.
Many of them are first-generation, and as first-generation students, they simply don't have engineers, doctors, lawyers in their families to give them this advice. The result is that they make really oftentimes poor college-going decisions and ultimately have a certain level of regret about what schools they chose, which majors they chose when they did go to school, and ultimately what careers they found themselves in.
Also, Taylor notes, school counselors need to pay better attention to some other considerations when giving advice. He admits that school counselors do the best they can to get students into college, but they do not often talk about the difficulties of finding a job in some fields or the consequences of heavy student debt, he says. Torzynski, Busteed, and Taylor all agree that, in the end, the amount of time and effort that students put in will decide how happy they are with their decisions. But students still need to be pointed in the right direction. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we talk about words and expressions that we use in everyday conversation. Today, we will talk about the word smart. Like many words, smart has lots of different meanings, depending on how and when you use it. For example, smart can describe someone who is very neat-looking. A person wearing an official uniform with shiny shoes and buttons can look very smart. We can also use smart as a verb. Used this way, it means to feel pain. That pain could be physical or emotional. So, if you hit your thumb with a hammer by accident, you might yell out, "Ow, that smarts!" This would be a very polite thing to yell when you experience extreme physical pain. Many of us probably wouldn't be that polite. We would probably yell something quite different. Okay, so that's the physical part. But a hurtful comment or remark can also smart. Those hurt in an emotional way. In another use of the word, we add smart to the names of devices and tools. This means that they are enabled by computers, like a smartphone. But by far, the most common definition of smart is to be very good at learning and understanding things. So when students do well at school and get good grades, we can call them smart. Being smart, however, goes beyond the classroom. People can be smart in different ways. If you have attended school for many years and have many degrees, people might call you book smart. Book smart people are well read. They often know the names of great thinkers, scientists, and other famous people in history. They have read classical literature. They know facts and information that many other people don't. Usually, people with book smarts are good at things like trivia games and crossword puzzles. However, being book smart is not everything. Sometimes people who are very educated are not so smart when it comes to life skills and people skills. On the other hand, people who are good at dealing with practical life problems have lots of street smarts. People who have street smarts may not have read as many books or earned college degrees, but they have something just as valuable: the ability to use their experiences in many different situations. They are very aware of their surroundings. Okay, so whether you are book smart, street smart, or both, being smart is a good thing. Usually. It may surprise you, but getting smart is not good. In conversation, getting smart does not mean gathering knowledge. It means you are being rude or impolite. It is very common to hear parents say to their children, "Do not get smart with me." And that's not the only smart expression that can get you into trouble. We often pair smart with off to make a very useful phrasal verb, to smart off. Smarting off to someone means you are saying rude comments and showing a lack of respect. In this context, the adjective smart is not good. If a child has a smart mouth, they often say disrespectful, rude things. In the classroom, students who give smart answers are trying to be funny by saying rude or inappropriate things. Let's say there is a student who has a really smart mouth. She gives the teacher a smart answer in class one too many times. The teacher may say to her, "Do not get smart with me, young lady," or "Do not smart off in class." Both mean, "Do not be rude." There is another type of smart that is bad. Okay, we have all met someone who thinks they know everything about everything. Well, you can call that person a smarty pants. These know-it-all types can be really annoying. But please note that this insult can sound a bit childish. So being smart, whether book smart or street smart, is a great thing to be. Except when it's not. And that's it for Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
The air in the Indian capital, New Delhi, is among the most polluted of any city in the world. That is one reason India's highest court has ordered a temporary ban on firecracker sales during Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights. The observance lasts 5 days. During this period, many Hindus light oil lamps in homes, windows, and on housetops. Crowds gather to watch fireworks at night. But the court order has angered many Indians as they prepare for Diwali, which starts October 19th. They say the order prevents them from taking part in a Hindu tradition, the lighting of fireworks. Critics have likened the court's action to banning Christmas trees on Christmas Day. Yet supporters of the firecracker ban say the health of New Delhi's 18 million residents is more important than traditions. They note that the city's air can endanger human health at this time of the year because of slower winds and colder temperatures that trap more pollution. When the Indian Supreme Court announced its decision on Monday, one of the judges said, "Let's try at least one Diwali without firecrackers." The court banned fireworks last year, but only after the Diwali festival, when smog had already covered much of New Delhi. The ban was partly lifted last month. But it was put back in place after lawyers for three children asked the court to force the city to clean up its air. Supporters of the ban hope the decision will keep air pollution from reaching the levels it did last year. In the days after the 2016 festival, air quality was almost 20 times the safe limit set by the World Health Organization. Many people became sick. That led New Delhi officials to take emergency measures, including closing schools. Recently, officials temporarily banned trucks from the city, limited the movement of other motor vehicles, and suspended work at building projects. Opponents of the ban ask why only firecrackers are being targeted. They say it is more important to deal with the causes of air pollution, including the large number of vehicles and the burning of waste in neighboring states. They say the explosion of firecrackers for a few hours will not affect the air pollution problem. But environmental experts say the ban will help at a time when the air is already full of pollutants. In 2015, researchers reported that the lungs of half of the children in New Delhi have been damaged because of poor air quality. Doctors blame the pollution for an increase in breathing disorders and heart attacks. They tell older adults to leave the city in winter. Harsh Vardhan is India's environment minister. He supports the ban. He has urged people to obey it, adding that the country should give green Diwali and our environment a chance. But some members of his Hindu nationalist party, BJP, are angry about the court's decision. One party official noted that the ban affects only the sale of firecrackers and not their use. Tajinder Singh Baga said he plans to give firecrackers to poor children in the city, as he does each year. He said when he announced on social media that he would do so, many people sent the message, "We also want to distribute because of this ban," because people were in anger. Chetan Bhagat is a well-known writer in India. He said on Twitter that officials should regulate, don't ban, respect traditions. I'm Jonathan Evans.
This week, our National Parks journey across the United States takes us to southwestern Colorado. We are visiting a large U.S. national park called Mesa Verde. It was established to protect the culture of ancient Native Americans. Mesa Verde National Park is over 100 years old. In 1906, then-President Theodore Roosevelt signed a bill creating the park. Mesa Verde offers visitors a look into the lives of the ancestral Pueblo people, who lived in the area between 700 and 1,400 years ago. The national park protects almost 5,000 archaeological sites. They are some of the best preserved archaeological areas in the country.
The term Mesa Verde is Spanish for green table. Early Spanish explorers gave the name to the area. In geology, a mesa is a flat-topped highland with steep sides. Mesa Verde is not actually a mesa. It is a cuesta, a term used to describe a hill with a sharp drop on one side and a soft, gentle slope on the other. A more correct name for the national park, then, would be Cuesta Verde. The gently sloping side of Mesa Verde was important in the formation of the 600 cliff dwellings within the park. Cliff dwellings are living areas that were set up in caves, the large open areas in the side of the cliff.
Mesa Verde rises more than 540 meters above the ground. Visitors can drive to the top of the hill on a winding mountain road. In the distance are the flatlands and mountains of an area called the Four Corners. That is where the western states of Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona meet. Some of the ruins in the Four Corners area are from the earliest people who lived there. They were hunters and gatherers, now known as basket makers. The basket makers lived in simple caves. The first evidence that ancient people had moved to Mesa Verde is from about 1,500 years ago. Those people lived in pit houses, large holes in the ground with wood and mud covering the top. In the 8th century, the early Pueblo people began building square structures of large connected rooms, or pueblos, above ground. More than 300 years later, they climbed down the canyon walls and began building cliff dwellings.
Today, visitors to Mesa Verde National Park can see some of the remains of all four kinds of settlements. Visitors are able to explore several of Mesa Verde's renowned cliff dwellings. Many of them take several hours to reach by foot. Signs along some of the paths point to trees and plants used by the ancestral Puebloan people. Visitors will also find the juniper and pinyon pine trees that make Mesa Verde green. Cliff Palace is the largest cliff dwelling in Mesa Verde and North America. It has 150 rooms. It is not easy to get to Cliff Palace. Visitors must climb down into the canyon on a narrow path with many steps. They must also climb down several ladders. But the trip is well worth the effort. Visitors can examine this beautiful structure made of stone and clay. Spruce Treehouse is the third largest cliff dwelling in Mesa Verde. It has 114 rooms. It also has 8 underground rooms called kivas. Pueblo Indian men gathered in the kivas for ceremonies. Spruce Treehouse is usually the easiest cliff dwelling to visit. The path winds down into the valley and then up to the ruins. But visitors have not been able to explore Spruce Treehouse since October of 2015. After rocks fell near the area. Park officials closed the site for safety reasons.
Mesa Verde National Park occupies 21,000 hectares of land in Montezuma County, Colorado. About 500,000 people visit the park each year. Archaeologists working in Mesa Verde have recovered many objects that the ancient Pueblo people used, including tools and jewelry. Many of the objects can be seen in the visitors' center. However, human remains or any object from a burial area may not be touched or shown. This is to respect the wishes of the modern Puebloan people who live in the area today. Mesa Verde has been recognized as a special place. The United Nations named it as one of the first World Heritage Sites in 1978. Today's Pueblo Indians consider Mesa Verde a sacred place, and for visitors from around the world, it remains a place of mystery and beauty. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.